The generator is back on. Well, this is just, it'll be part of the soundtrack.
But that's part of the experience here in Irvine.
And we are on the 7th floor balcony of an upscale apartment building in Parkview, which is like kind of a gated community type situation. So they have enough money to ensure that that when the city power goes off, they never have to lose power.
Yes, exactly. So that's what they do. Also, it's some sort of a profit for them, like a continuous profit going on.
Yeah.
They make use of the fact that the electricity from government is not able to provide 24-hour electricity to people. So they make money by charging more.
So they're not highly invested in the actual infrastructure of the city getting better. They want it.
No, unfortunately, it's just a temporary solution, but they're making the best out of it.
Do you not get overwhelmed when you see a city that grows so organically and so just, any way it can?
Yes.
And you're trying to, sort of say like, hey, this is a proper way to do this, or let's be organized in our thinking, that the government has to be able to have the confidence to think 50 years down the road instead of like, what's going to be built 5 years out.
Yeah, more of a long-term vision for how the city should look like in 50 years from now and how it's going to meet the people needs in 50 years from now. And that's unfortunately not the way of thinking. It's a way of thinking because of all the conflicts this region was going through. People are used to fleeing away every now and then.
Fair enough. It is sort of ironic for a place that is just about one of the oldest cities on earth. That dates back to ancient Sumeria.
Yes.
That there's a lack of long-term thinking. I think the Sumerians were long-term planners.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we
they lasted for
them.
Long.
Exactly.
Yes.
Take a page from Sumerian design and city planning.
Just over the horizon from the balcony where we were standing is where ISIS's advance stalled out in 2014. ISIS, with their pickup trucks and shitty laws and black battle flags, had come less than 30 miles from the capital of Kurdistan. In that environment, one of jihadism and civil war and occasional genocide, it's so tempting to think short term. It's contagious. It makes politicians and lenders and small business owners think about how to make the most money right now, to distrust the future, to be wary of building anything of long-term value. You can see the results of that mindset in the half-finished towers of abandoned subdivisions, bleached like whale bones on the outskirts of the city. And yet, the Kurds are still here. They will be here. They will be living in the capital they've built for themselves for decades and centuries to come. Might as well bet long on your own region and start thinking big thoughts about how to make this the capital it should be. That's where Basma Abdulrahman comes in. A civil and structural engineer with a master's from Auburn University, she has made green city planning and sustainable architecture her cause here in Kurdistan. It's something you see a lot of in the United States, even more in Europe. But in this part of the world, her push for building a longer-lasting, more well-planned capital is a sign of perhaps unreasonable optimism, something that is valuable pre-COVID when we had recorded this conversation, and even more so today. I'm Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. So you wanted to drink tea, but why?
Because this is our drink. That's what we have in the morning, after lunch, after dinner. Going out with friends, we usually get tea, Iraqi tea.
Iraqi tea. And the tea houses, the places that are kind of lining the streets with wood-burning stoves, it's like you get it's like almost ritualistic, I guess.
Yes.
And I also, one of the things that has amazed me and I find just very charming, like probably a better life style, is there's a lot of patiently just kind of sitting next to somebody at the park and just talking. I say that like it's revelation, but that just doesn't really happen in a city this size anyway in the States.
The culture here is playing a big role when it comes to sitting next to random people and started talking. People are curious about each other. They're usually nice. They like to be nice to others. They don't like to sit alone and just, you know, look into the distance and try to reflect like what we do as millennials. We try to stay isolated from others. But I think in general, people are kind. And they're very social, and that's what makes them like talking to random people sitting next to them.
Yeah, this is what I've also heard, why Kurdish people in the United States have a bit of culture shock too, of just like, you know, losing that ability to make connections, losing the interest in just chatting and hanging out in the plaza. It's not a big feature of American life. All right, well, so tell me your name and let's start with your company and what it does and how you got there.
So my name is Basim Abdurrahman. I'm a Baghdad born Kurd and I lived in Baghdad until 2006. We moved to Kurdistan afterwards because of the civil unrest and sectoral conflict that was happening there. I have an engineering background. I have a bachelor in civil engineering and a master's in structural engineering. I worked with the government for some time. I didn't like it. That's why I applied for master's. I had no plan. Okay. I just wanted something different. When I was doing my master's, I was working a lot in doing building structural design, and I didn't like it. And then when I came back to Iraq around January 2015, it was the peak time when ISIS came in and all the military operations are happening and all the disruption happening across the country, and it was a bit different, and there were not much companies working, not much development happening, even here in Kurdistan. So I just joined the United Nations for some time. The type of interventions they do is nice. Still, I didn't like it. but as an environmentalist, I love environment. I care so much about nature, about other creatures, and I feel responsible. I was introduced to the concept of green building at some point. I was interested to learn more about it. So I went by my own twice to the States to study more about it. I got accredited in this area.
This was at Auburn.
So I did my master's in structural engineering in Auburn. I spent there a little bit over than 2 years. And that's when I came back and joined the United Nations here. But then while I'm with the United Nations, I was taking some time off to go back to the States to study a little bit more about green building. So I went to conferences, I took some trainings, and then I took two exams, one in 2016, one in 2017, to become lead professional. And when I came back in July 2017, I thought to myself, there are no green building companies here. There is no way I'm leaving the country, because that's the main reason I came back from the States after doing my master's there, is that I wanted to help build back the country because of all the destruction was happening from terrorist groups. So I thought to myself, why not start it myself? So I have the background, I have the expertise, I have the passion for it. And that's how I started Kesk. It means green in Kurdish.
It means green. And you're, when you say the country and the, what you want to rebuild and the fact that there's no LEED certification, that's all about Kurdistan? Or is there no kind of green building movement in all of Iraq?
There are no green building movements or specialized companies or any projects of this type happening anywhere in Iraq. So we are technically the first.
So you just have to do it yourself.
Yes, we are going to pave the road, but hopefully we will not be by ourselves.
You won't be alone on this long journey. Well, let me start with that one part about coming back from the United States, because you know, I think that's it's a big theme here. It's a big problem, is that all the good ones leave, right?
Yes.
I mean, what makes you different, or are there a number of people who have made the kind of commitment that you've made?
I know a number of other scholars who went to the States and came back. But yeah, the majority usually stays because people want to have a good life, and they like living in the States, and helps them advance personally and professionally. And in my case, it was something more like a personal decision. It happened on the night when ISIS took over some of the main big cities in Iraq. I remember that night, I was following up with my family, and they were worried. ISIS was very close, 10 kilometers away from Erbil city. And I got really worried, and I felt sad and ashamed, you know, because I did not want to be associated with this, with all this mess. Then I had this, I don't know what to call it, this moment of clarity, I guess.
Yeah, that sounds... well, let's hear what it was, and then we can name it.
Yeah, when you hit the rock bottom, and then the only way is to go up again. And that's when I felt, you know what? Maybe I can help somehow. I didn't know what I'm going to do then. I just thought I should go back. I should do something good. I was more thinking towards things related to how can we promote this region as this very old historical region that was rich with all the knowledge, all the history, all the good things. And so the rest of the world will not only think of us based on the last three decades of this region's life, and that's what I wanted to promote.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
So you were in the States when ISIS took over,
is it?
And that's when you were talking to your family that was here in Erbil.
Yes.
And I imagine also, I mean, Kurdistan was a refuge for you and your family already once, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that can be a powerful thing to realize that, you know, you're not always safe everywhere else, and here's a place where Kurds can actually live.
Yes.
So in the motto environmentalists, like, don't destroy, you know, your bit of land, right?
Exactly.
I mean, one of the reasons why I was excited to talk to you is because I think a number of the people that I'm talking to here are connected directly to the conflicts in one way or the other, and
mm-hmm.
and that's important, and it's obviously a huge part of what's been happening here. It's a huge part of everybody's lives, but the ability to kind of pick your head up and look around and think of the bigger picture, even in an era of crisis, I think is also really fascinating and takes a special mentality, I think. So when everybody here is concerned about, you know, building for security and making sure that they, you know, that their, you know, buildings won't be bombed and so on, you know, that, that for you to say, well, wait a second, like peace will be here one day and then we'll have to reckon with what we've built and the lives that we're leading in it. I think it's a fascinating ability to kind of look deeper into the future. Is it hard to make that argument?
It's about the perception of the public. It's not easy. It takes time. But it has to happen because, like you said, peace is coming. Peace is going to be the norm one day. And we are, I feel, on the brink of this new era. And hopefully the next years are just going to be about rebuilding and developing and advancing in all different sectors. And when we think in a more futuristic way, when we think long-term, we are embracing this this belief that we are going to be living in peace, right?
So and you can kind of manifest it and
exactly.
Make it happen.
So this is the kind of way of thinking we want to promote. Let's not just think of how things are going to be in the next 5 to 10 years. We need to think further. And any investment has to be done, whether by public or private sector, should be around this way of thinking. A futuristic, forward-thinking kind of investment, and to make sure that current and future generations are going to benefit from every single penny we are putting into developing this region.
How do you make that case? How do you change minds?
When I start talking about environment, climate change, I don't see much response, or people tend to think more towards what's in it for us. So I have to sell it more in terms of financials, saying, if you put this amount of money to build this type of structure or infrastructure, this is going to come back as a profit. And this amount of money depends on how much you put into it. And basically I have to sell it in terms of money.
You make it an economic argument.
Yes.
Is there one to make? It's not just altruistic. There can be a way that they profit from investing in this kind of building.
Exactly, because when you are investing in sustainable building, you save money in terms of energy and water use. And we have a lot of difficulties. We were just talking outside about the shortage of electricity we have here. So we need less consumption of that. And the population is growing, and the more it's growing, you have to meet the demand. And at some point, you will end up not able to meet the demand with the available resources. And that's why you have to invest into sustainable development, because that is going to address these issues that we're going to have in the future. And let's not be just very short-term in our way of thinking and think of ourselves and our kids, because we're talking about a lifelong of other generations coming, what they're going to think of us when they see how badly we functioned when it comes to development. And there's something I always say, we have this very long history and experience in building. We have Zokrut, we have the Citadel, we have many examples that shows that humans were doing amazing when it comes to building.
Yeah, I mean, this is, what they say about the Citadel is it's like the oldest continuously inhabited structure on Earth.
Exactly.
I mean, this town dates back to Sumerians and before. So it's a very, very, very long time.
So we need to prove that we have evolved as human.
Yeah, fair.
And it has to be reflected somehow in the way we build. That is also something to think of, not to just go traditionally and, you know, think of in basic and in a very simple way of thinking. We need to go more deep.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd been talking to someone who grew up in Ankawa, where you live and where I'm staying, which is the, I guess, traditionally had been a Christian village on the outskirts of Erbil. But there was an old village that just got totally torn down, and they just threw up a bunch of concrete buildings in its place. And that was a generation ago or more. But, you know, there was a real sense of loss, I guess, among the people who had, like, who had grown up in a village that was a certain way, and then it kind of turned into somewhat of an urban sprawl. But like you said, you're anticipating when this fighting finally stops, and it's well on its way, you know, inshallah, to stopping.
Inshallah.
But it does feel like there's going to be a lot of decisions to be made. There's going to be a lot of buildings that will go up and a lot of needs that will be finally addressed. And so you want to be ahead of that, to just sort of say, like, hey, there's a model of talking about these issues, and the company's already there, and, you know, we have our credentials, and we've been telling this message. Has it started already, or is it more that you're in waiting for that big boom?
We are having discussions with as many stakeholders as possible involved in the rebuilding process, in the development process. It just that we have reached to the conclusion that we need to work top down. And that means that we need to work with the government. We have to have the government beside us to support whatever activities and services we provide. And the reason why? Because developers are more profit-oriented thinkers.
Right.
And when I was talking to one of them just a few days ago, and I'm talking to about a developer that built huge complexes, thousands of units at the time, and I was talking about how good sustainable buildings are and how we can help them provide these units to people, affordable, sustainable housing that will help reduce energy and water consumption. And he was like, but we don't want people to use less energy and water. We make money from people using energy and water because we provide now electricity and water privately. And we want them to use more. That means more money for us.
That's a remarkable statement.
Yes. And but
I mean,
for
was
me,
there any self-awareness from him about like just how just deeply, deeply flawed and short-sighted that concept is? Or he's just like, listen, it's more money.
For them, it's about having more money. I mean, they're investors, and he was very clear about it. He was like, I'm an investor. Everything for me is about how much I make. And the other type of stakeholders are humanitarian organizations who are heavily involved in the rebuilding. And somehow can also influence government. They also lack the expertise in this area. So they are committed to invest sustainably. They also have their own struggles and difficulties when it comes to availability of fund. What's this fund need to be spent on? They have to provide indicators and specific numbers that they cannot reduce when it comes to number of units to rebuild, to rehabilitate, and all of that. And that would leave them with like really small amount of budget for every single unit they build. And it will not meet sustainability requirements and standards. And it will end up just providing something basic as sheltering.
Yeah.
If the government is enforcing these requirements and standardization for rebuilding and development, everybody else will follow.
you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility, because before ISIS came, Kurdistan was selling itself as, you know, a region of the future, you know, the next Dubai, as gets used by a lot of, you know, kind of hype men for different areas. But it's definitely something that they were pitching here, the desire to be seen as modern, to be seen as in front. And particularly the reality that in a lot of ways Kurdistan continues to be ahead of other regions of Iraq and can sort of take pride in that position and model that way, makes me feel like there could be a receptive audience if they believe what they're saying about their own future.
Exactly.
Now, you never know.
So thinking about the future has to be somehow promoted not to just look like other cities, to function also as other cities. Because if you think of Dubai, they are very highly sustainable and they invest a lot in green and sustainable building. And they have also their own standards that they follow. They have built their own rating system for green and sustainable buildings. So they don't just have fancy looking buildings. They're
fancy on the inside.
Yeah, they're also fancy on the inside.
in their skeletons, in their structure.
Exactly.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You had mentioned environmental concerns kind of falling on deaf ears, which is something we know, you know, all too well in the United States, where getting people to, you know, believe in climate change is even somehow a struggle. How is climate change affecting Kurdistan, and what, you know, what are the kind of crises that are coming up?
You would be surprised, but the region is classified as one of the top five places or regions in the world in terms of vulnerability to climate change.
Really? Why?
Yes, it's because of environment degradation due to neglection of government in the past three decades, rise of temperatures, drought, loss of agricultural land to drought due to climate change. So many different issues that are created as a consequence of having climate change effect happening here. But because we don't have much studies going on to address and highlight these issues, so we are kind of not aware of it.
But basically, it's a man-made crisis kind of compounding what's happening in the overall structure of things. So, I mean, Kurdistan, in terms of its climate, right now it's been raining some, so it's very, very green.
Which is unusual.
Yeah. I've heard this. I've heard that this is basically looks like Ireland compared to what Kurdistan usually is. But from the mountains to the kind of the high plains, it's in danger of desertification if the drought continues and you have your, you know, kind of the onward trend.
And also the reduction of water stream coming from upstate. We have mismanagement of our resources, like natural resources, water. All of these are challenges that are contributing to the crisis. And I think the next ISIS would be environment degradation and desertification if we don't really pay good attention to it.
Yeah, man, does that analogy work? Like, I guess that's kind of what we have to do in the States too, is try to instill reasonable fear, you know, not panic, but just like appropriate fear about what's happening.
Be responsible, basically. Just feeling responsible will help somehow that you work in a way that helps somehow mitigate this big crisis that is falling on everybody, not just us. If climate change is happening in the US, that doesn't mean it wouldn't happen here, because we are not emitting as much greenhouse gas emissions. So it's going to happen everywhere. Like, it's just not one region-specific kind of crisis. It's just happening all over the planet. So that's why everybody has to contribute towards mitigating it.
So you have all of these sets of kind of unusual perspectives, I guess, and unusual arguments, at least for the day, that you're making to government and others. But another thing that certainly, and this would stand out in the States as well, is, you know, being a female entrepreneur who has started her own company in engineering to go and bang the drums and convince all of the men in power, basically, to make these changes. What is that like for you, and how does that affect what you have to do or how you have to do it?
Being a female entrepreneur?
Yeah.
It's giving me somehow more power. You would be surprised. People would listen. They wouldn't, because maybe from the first side, they would think, oh, that's a female is going to tell us how we should do things. But then when you're talking from knowledge, from expertise, this mask will just disappear, and they will just see someone who knows what is talking about, and they would listen. So surprisingly, I haven't felt ever that I am judged or not heard because of being a female. I think maybe that is giving me more power and setting a good example for other females to just step forward when they believe and want to do something. They believe in something, they just step up.
One of the things that's been interesting in my short time here is just also how segregated spaces are. I mean, you might be the first woman I've seen in maybe 24 hours because...
Oh, wow.
I know.
Where were you in the past 24 hours?
Not to get weird or anything, but I haven't seen, like, I don't know, we went out to go get street food at, like, Ispan Street, and it was just all men. I went to, we went to a Christian bar, you know, the Teachers Club in Ankawa or something, was also all men. And, you know, so this is kind of... now I'm obviously seeking out male spaces, I guess, here, but you, as someone who had spent time in Auburn and knows the United States really well, but is Kurdish, like, I mean, what are the differences in what you have to navigate here in Kurdistan versus if you were doing this in the United States?
Definitely, I guess. I think in terms of being a female, it wouldn't be that different.
Yeah.
Especially we're talking about the startup ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean...
Females are still struggling in the States.
And a lot of all these STEM stories about issues.
These stories about how Silicon Valley is not the perfect place and environment for women and entrepreneurs, female entrepreneurs. And I think it wouldn't be that different. I feel more comfortable here because I feel this is my space. These are my people. I might not look or act or work as any other typical female here, but still, this is where I feel I'm comfortable, and I know people here, and I know very well the way of thinking, the traditions. I try not to really disrupt when it comes to really certain traditions and beliefs.
So you're not going to go to the male-only street food corridor?
I would do that.
You would? Okay.
I would do that. Yeah, and I like doing this with friends, and people here are very, very kind. And they welcome people from different backgrounds and personalities. I've done this a lot. I go to local places, we sit, we eat kebab, and we look, you know, completely out of place.
Yeah.
Especially sometimes we go out with our gym outfit. We feel like, you know, this time to get some food, and we go sit somewhere local, and we kind of look out of place, but we don't feel we're out of place.
So it's not sort of an iron, you know, regulation around kind of who can go where. It's no, just this is the way it's just traditionally done.
Yes.
But if you have a mind to do it differently, then
So a little story. The other day we went to Shaklawa, and we wanted some tea. We didn't have. We had the tea bags and all the ingredients, but we didn't have hot water. We needed hot water, so we stopped by some local coffee place, and it was packed with men. And Shaklawa is even more rural than Erbil city. And it was me, my sister, and another female friend. We went in. We were just, you know, very casual. We went in, we asked for some hot water, and the guy helped us, the tea guy, and he also offered to keep it for some time at his stove for it to, you know, to brew and get more tasty. And men were sitting there, and they were just talking to each other, and it was just fine.
So it wasn't like the record scratch moment where all heads turn immediately and like, oh my God, who are these
three? At the beginning,
three?
Everybody, I'm sure everybody was thinking what just happened, but then, you know, this very first uncomfortable moment passed through, and then everything was just normal.
It is interesting, and I guess it's a part of just life, you know, since time immemorial in Kurdistan. We're here in Ramadan, which is a holiday with some very clear sets of rules that generally are supposed to be obeyed by the majority of the population. Of course, there's really large Christian population here in Erbil, and it's just kind of interesting the way that they all kind of navigate each other's preferences and interests. I don't know, it seems kind of natural and casual in a way that I guess I hadn't quite expected.
Yes.
You know, the Christian owners of the hotel in Ankawa that we are staying in were like, oh yeah, you can definitely have a beer, but, you know, have it indoors so that people aren't
because
aren't
it's
seeing,
Ramadan.
Yeah, because
we don't
it's
want
Ramadan.
To offend anybody.
Yeah, so it's like, it's not, it, you know, it, they're not like diving across the counter to grab the beer out of your hands, or, you know, for fear that their neighbors are going to hate them or anything. It just seemed like it's a very soft or like smooth negotiation, I guess, that society does here. Mm-hmm. Because it's so mixed. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that's true with the relation of the sexes here. It's just like, you can be your own person, and you can be the individual who you were meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
And people aren't trying to put you in some sort of category that you don't desire.
Yes. So there is this, I call it acceptance. Acceptance to differences, acceptance to others. People live together for a very long time, and they, despite the differences, they have learned just to, you know, accommodate each other. And this acceptance is something's precious.
Tell me if you were thinking, since you're the master of long-term thinking for for this region, okay, we're going to assume that peace is coming soon. Like, what will Erbil look like in 25 years? What could it be?
So, definitely advanced in terms of much technology is embedded in every single aspect. I believe cities who are developing as fast as Erbil city would be these big, huge data generators.
Hmm.
This is the image of future cities, that everything is going to be tracked, recorded, and processed. Public transportation and health institutions and everything would be just highly advanced in technology and fast and productive. That's how I hope it would look like. But also at the same time, it would keep its own identity and culture and reflect people's beliefs and differences and different views and so
that even in
having this beautiful balance between futuristic and human touch of it. So
even in the high tech sort of capital of Kurdistan of the future, where data is making things more efficient and sort of bringing order to the infrastructure, you still will have the chance and the space for people to sit and drink tea and just kind of watch people go by.
Exactly. Walk around and talk to random people.
embrace this behavior. The classic sports of Kurdish life. Well, that's a good note to leave it on, as we can just sort of sit here and look out the window and drink tea and imagine the future. I just think it's wonderful that you were doing this and kind of have bridged both from the States back to here and that you are here. You know that, yeah, that this is where you're making your stand is pretty remarkable. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me here. I loved it.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Emily Marinoff was our producer on this episode. Taffy Mulkinyadze was our consulting producer. Alexa Van Sickle is our online editor. Music by Day and the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Genghis Yar was the producer on this and all of our Iraq episodes. Next on this feed, Monday, November 2nd, we are kicking off our Cuba series with a huge talent, someone I have admired for years, the poet and singer and MC Tel Mari. We talk rum and rumba, hip-hop and Havana. We will meet you there.